I fear not the dark itself, but what may lurk within it. Welcome to Lurk, bringing you creepy, strange, and bone-chilling stories, with your host, Jamie Jackson.
Hey Lurkers, it's Jamie. Welcome to episode 20 and happy Friday. Today, as promised, we'll be discussing the missing 411 case of Jared Atadero, who was a three-year-old who went missing in Colorado. We have talked about one other missing 411 case. It was episode 4, the case of Dennis Martin. And in case you're new to the podcast or new to the missing 411 topic, Missing 411 refers to a series of books written by a gentleman named David Pilates. Mr. Pilates is a former police detective who had 20 years in law enforcement. He was approached by off-duty park rangers about disappearances in the national parks and the unusual circumstances that surrounded those disappearances. That research ended up being the beginning of the Missing 411 books. Most of these cases where people disappeared, most of these cases have a specific criteria. The ones that David Pilates includes in his books, they have specific criteria. I won't go over the whole list, but basically they go missing in rural areas. A lot of them happen in national parks, not all of them. There's usually no witnesses, there's significant cover, difficult terrain. Tracking dogs are unable or unwilling to search. There's usually some type of severe weather that moves in pretty quick after the disappearance happens. This, of course, could be part of the problem with the tracking dogs, and usually the weather hampers the investigation in some way. A lot of the disappearances happen between 2 and 5 p.m. A lot of times the person is found in an area that has been extensively searched already, and yet they show up in that area, even though it's been searched multiple times. So that's just some of the instances, some of the criteria surrounding these cases. There's usually more than that. The book that I used for this research is Missing 411 Western United States and Canada. I also use newspapers.com, and I read the book Missing When the Sun Sets, the Jared Atadero story, which was written by Jared's father, Alan Atadero. So as I mentioned previously, I don't like to call this my favorite case, but this is the case that sticks with me the most and speaks to me the most, and the one that I try to figure out the most, I guess is the best way to say it. There's a lot of questions, a lot of mystery surrounding this case. I think that's a big part of the reason why it intrigues me. And I've read Alan Atadero's book. I've also heard him speak. I've heard different interviews. He used to have a Facebook page, and I followed that as well, and he just was a huge advocate for his son. He just really seemed to be going above and beyond, and just had such a, I don't want to say positive outlook, but the way he processed and dealt with everything, I just really admired Jared's dad, Alan, in the whole thing. So that is another reason why this case is one that kind of sticks with me. At the time of his disappearance, Jared is just a few months shy of his fourth birthday. He was born January 2nd, 1996. He goes missing October 2nd, 1999. And at the time of his disappearance, his dad, Alan Atadero, and his dad's twin brother, Arlen, owned the Poudre River Resort in Colorado. Alan was also a teacher in Littleton, Colorado. I believe he was a phys ed teacher. So this first weekend in October, Alan is hosting a group from the Christian Singles Network. The weekend was supposed to be a work weekend. So basically the members of the group would do chores around the resort in exchange for their lodging. Alan knew the people in the group. He was friends with them. He was a member of the Christian Singles Network. And they had had prior work weekends before, including the members of the group. So they had been to his resort. He knew them. He was a member of the group. He was familiar with all of them. One of the members of the group was a woman named Janet, and she was friends with Alan and was also well-known and well-liked by both of Alan's kids. So Alan had 3-year-old Jared, and he also had 6-year-old Jocelyn, who was Jared's sister. So on October 2nd, the group decides they want to go visit a fish hatchery, which is located only about 1.5 miles away from the resort. 6-year-old Jocelyn asks her dad if she could go. He agrees. Like most times when the older sibling is allowed to go somewhere, the younger sibling, of course, starts nagging mom or dad, wanting to go too. So Jared, of course, he wants to go. And at first, Alan tells him, no, you can't go. Alan was not going. He needed to stay at the resort, and he just wasn't comfortable with his son going off. But the adults in the group assured Alan that it was just a fish farm. It was nothing too strenuous, perfectly harmless. So Alan ends up saying, sure, go ahead, you can go, Jared. Since it was only 1.5 miles away and it's an easy walk, it wasn't too strenuous, and they were going with the family friend, they were going with Janet. So in total, there were 11 adults hiking in the group plus the 2 kids, Jocelyn and Jared. At some point, unbeknownst to Alan, the group of adults decides they wanted something more challenging than the mild walk around the fish hatchery. And they end up driving to Big South Trail, which is located 15 to 16 miles away from the resort. This trail is also a much more difficult hiking trail. It's not a simple, easy walk around some fish ponds. It's a significant hike. The Big South Trail is 11 miles long. It's located in the rugged Comanche Peak Wilderness, which eventually crosses into the Rocky Mountain National Park. Definitely more difficult than walking around a fish farm. The trail has moderate ups and downs. In some areas, the ledges of the trail are only about 2 feet wide. And there's also areas that have loose shale and rock that go from the trail all the way downhill to the river. So if you slid, you could end up just continuing to slide right down into the river. As I said, Alan is completely unaware that the group has changed their plans. He is still at the resort. He actually mentioned in one interview that he was a little taken aback that the group had actually gone hiking, because they were supposed to be there to do a cleanup weekend in exchange for their lodging. So they're supposed to be spending their Saturday doing some chores around the resort, and instead they've gone off hiking. So he was kind of taken aback by that they weren't really holding up their end of the bargain with this work weekend. So the group gets to the trailhead, they park, and they start their hike. And the group separated into 2 groups based on hiking speed. This is pretty typical. This happens all the time when I go hiking with the scouts. Usually with the scouts themselves hike far faster than the leaders. And so they're in front. The leaders are towards the back. But any group you have, usually you end up separating into the faster and slower hikers. According to Janet, the family friend, when she was interviewed by investigators, there were 2 men and 1 woman in the very front. And behind them was Jared. And then behind Jared were 2 men with fishing poles. Behind the fishermen, there was 1 man and 3 women, and that included Janet. And then there was 1 child with them, who was Jocelyn. The other part of the group was much slower, and they were further behind. While they're hiking, Janet lost sight of the front group when they turned around a corner, and she said she never passed them and that apparently they had gone off trail. This is when she loses sight of Jared. So speaking with another member of the group named Anthony, investigators were able to get a more specific timeline. Anthony said the group started out on the trail at 10:40 a.m. They last saw Jared between 11:20 and 11:30 a.m. They turned back between 12:50 and 1 p.m., and they arrived at the trailhead about 1:30 to 1:40 p.m., and that's when they went back to the resort to alert Alan that Jared was missing. Anthony also stated the fishermen had told them they saw Jared going up the trail. The fishermen caught up with Jared, and he hung with them until they went off to go fishing. They told investigators that they have fished in that area a lot this year, but have not seen any signs of bear or mountain lions. The fishermen said that when they took the fork to head to the river, Jared stayed on the trail, and that the group was about 5 to 10 minutes behind him. Jared apparently asked if there were any bears around there, which they said they hadn't seen any, and this was about 11:30 a.m. When investigators talked to the group, several people mentioned that they heard a scream, though there were discrepancies about whether the scream sounded like a fearful scream or if it sounded more like a playful one. One member of the group was standing on some boulders in or near the river, and while they were there, they said they thought they heard the sound of what they thought was keys jingling, like somebody was walking by on the trail and had keys in their hand or clipped to their belt or something, and that they were jingling. But when they looked up, they didn't really see anybody there. So Alan is at the resort and he's relaxing and he hears a commotion in the store. The store was off of the living quarters of the resort. So Alan gets up and he goes to see what's going on, and he sees some of the members of the Christian Singles Network who had gone on the hike are in the store. One woman says to him that there is a problem with Jared, but then she says, "He's okay, we just can't find him," which seems on the surface like an odd thing to say, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say I think they were trying to reassure Alan, probably reassure themselves, and attempt to not panic. Not just Alan, but also to try to keep their panic down. Like, "He's okay, we know he's okay, we just can't find him, but we're going to," type of attitude. This is when Alan realizes, he learns that the group weren't at the fish hatchery a mile and a half down the road, that they were on this Big South Trail 15 to 16 miles away. So Alan leaves to head to the trail to go look for Jared. And he has it in his head that he's going to get there, he's going to go on the trail, he's going to call Jared's name, and Jared's going to come out of the woods and be fine. And everybody's going to go home, everybody's going to be happy, and that's going to be the end of the story. And I would think that most people would assume that. You think if you call your child, they're going to come out and you're going to find them and everything's going to be fine. So Alan walks up the trail calling for Jared using familiar names like Jared, J-Rod, and Little Man. And as Alan continues up the trail, that's when his panic starts to set in. He realizes at that point that the trail is actually very large and it's in a very remote area, and he still has not found Jared. Jared is not coming out of the woods. He's not being found. They're not finding him. And while he's there, Alan says in his book, "There were a million things to attract the curiosity of a child, and a million things to extinguish a child awash in that same curiosity. The farther I ran, the more I questioned why my babies were on this trail. I would never have brought them here, and if by chance I did, I would never have let go of their hands even for a second." You know, so he's saying, I don't know if anybody's ever hiked with a young kid. I've taken my grandson hiking. They're fascinated by everything. Sticks, water, puddles, rocks, flowers, birds, chipmunks, butterflies, you name it. They are fascinated by it. They don't think twice about trying to go check that out. But in remote areas, if they're not careful and they go to check something out, they could end up being hurt, being lost, being killed, because they just don't understand the dangers that are around them. My grandson just loves throwing rocks in water. I could see a river, which is paralleling the trail, being a huge draw for somebody young of that age and wanting to throw rocks in it, check it out, play in the water. Anything could happen. So Alan realizes this isn't going the way he expected it to go. He thought he was going to get there. He was going to call his name. Jared was going to be found. So he ends up walking back to the parking lot because he wants to see his daughter. He wants to see Jocelyn. He wants to know that she's okay and just get some reassurance. So when he gets to the parking lot, he's told that Jocelyn is still on the trail with Janet searching for Jared. And there was also a lot of mention that there's only one way in and one way out from the trail, and that's down through the trailhead to the parking lot. But even though there was only one way in and one way out, and that supposedly no one would be able to leave the trail without being noticed, Janet and Jocelyn had actually left the trail and driven away and headed back to the resort without anybody even noticing. So already a lot of the information is being disproved. The police and search and rescue had been notified, and they started arriving. So when Alan left the resort, one of the people who worked there at the resort had asked Alan if he wanted to contact the sheriff and search and rescue. Alan was like, I think I'm going to find him. I think we're okay. He didn't think they would need search and rescue. So he said no, and he left. The lucky thing is that this friend of Alan's is familiar with the area, and he's like, no, I'm calling. And so when Alan left, he calls search and rescue and the sheriff's department. So the ball was already rolling before Alan ever got to the point of realizing this was a much bigger problem than he originally thought. So police and search and rescue start arriving. They request someone to go to the resort to get articles of Jared's clothing for the search dogs. 6:30 p.m., search and rescue reach the lower Big South trailhead, and about 65 search and rescue members are at the trail at this point. This is still Saturday, October 2nd, 1999. 8 p.m., searchers from the lower and upper trailhead meet between campsites 7 and 8 without finding a sign of Jared. Search plans are expanded, and more resources are called in, which included a helicopter that was to arrive the next morning. At one point, Alan talks to his daughter, and Jocelyn tells her dad that Janet, who was the family friend they were with, was tired during the hike and laid down on a rock and closed her eyes. And Jocelyn also laid down. And it was after this that Jared could not be found. So the woman who was supposed to be in charge of his kids took a nap. And that's when she loses his kid. Basically, that's what happens. The next day, October 3rd, 1999, the second day Jared is missing, and there were search and rescue members who were searching during the night, and they were told to be extra watchful in the morning because the family had let them know that Jared typically woke up at dawn every day. So at the early morning hours, they were paying more extra attention to see if perhaps he'd wake up and they would be able to find him. 7 a.m., an Air Force helicopter out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, makes its first flight before leaving to head to Fort Collins to refuel. Alan receives a call from a woman with certified search dogs offering her services free of charge. He gives the phone to the sergeant in charge of the investigation, who talks to the woman, but he says she isn't needed, and if we need you, we'll call you. And yet he doesn't take any of the information down. This happens actually a few times where people were offering their services, but the sergeant in charge of the investigation said they weren't needed. 3:30 p.m., the Air Force helicopter is returning from refueling, and it starts struggling with the load of fuel and the mountain conditions. The conditions on the mountain, because of elevation and slope and different things, there were some crazy winds and stuff like that. So the helicopter starts struggling with the extra weight of the fuel and the crazy weather conditions of the mountains, and it stalls out and crashes on the Big South Trail about a mile and a half from the trailhead. All five people on board actually survive. Two of the people have some serious injuries. Everybody's transported to the hospital. Because of the amount of the emergency vehicles arriving because of the helicopter crash, people think that Jared has been found, and they begin calling Alan at the resort, asking him what's going on. Alan has no idea what's going on. He's at the resort, and he's waiting, and he's waiting, and he's waiting. And his ex-wife, who was there, she had gone into town to try to buy some items for their daughter, Jocelyn, and she's the one who mentions that it's a helicopter crash. Alan ends up calling the sheriff's dispatch to try to get information, try to get verification of the crash information. So he calls dispatch, and they don't want to tell him anything. They want to transfer him and not give him information. But he insists, and finally the dispatcher is like, yes, there was a helicopter crash. The only reason why the sheriff ended up calling him was because he called dispatch. They never notified him. They never said there's been an accident at the site, nothing. They had all these emergency vehicles. He had people calling him saying, oh my gosh, there's something going on at the site. I think maybe Jared's been found. And he's waiting and waiting and waiting, thinking, oh my gosh, maybe my son has been found. And he's waiting to be notified, and nobody even bothers to call him. There were quite a few, as I mentioned, search and rescue canine units. There were also experienced trackers, and they all offered their expertise, but they were all denied. And the sheriff's department kept the search and rescue people under tight control, and it only included people that they knew. I am going to say, and I'm going to bring up episode 4, the Dennis Martin case. That particular search and rescue effort was a zoo, and that hurt their search in that case for Dennis Martin. And because of that, search and rescue guidelines and the way that they conducted searches for missing people completely changed all over the globe because of that particular search. There were tons of people. There were hundreds and hundreds of people, volunteers, people who weren't so experienced. They were everywhere. I believe that some of this reluctance to allow outside people to come is the fact that you don't want a whole bunch of people coming in there and going through that, going through your search area. So I don't think it was necessarily a malicious choice of the sheriff's department. I think they're trying to keep control of who comes in and out and not have too many people there. They already had search dogs and trackers. They didn't really need to have more. So I do want to say that. I don't think that was a bad choice on the part of the sheriff. And I just don't think that Alan, as a concerned father whose son is missing, I mean, his 3-year-old son is gone. And of course he wants everybody out there looking. I think that's a typical response. October 4th, 1999, day 3. Jared's been missing for 3 days at this point. Searchers are now combing the riverbanks. They're checking really steep slopes. They have dive teams that's searching areas of the river, and a plane made a pass over the area. There was also some talk about using infrared technology, and Alan was told that there really wasn't any infrared technology available. There were no planes equipped with that nearby. There was an issue with getting that. Later, Alan found out that really isn't the case. There were a couple pilots who said, I have that capability, and nobody asked me to offer this service. I mention that mostly because it will come up a little bit later. Another helicopter comes to aid the search, but the winds that are created by the mountains required the helicopter to fly at full power in order to prevent it from crashing, so it ended up returning back to Fort Collins. The conditions of the mountain really hampered any helicopter use. While Alan is at the resort, because he stayed at the resort pretty much the whole time. After that initial time where he went to the trailhead to search for his son the first day, he is at the resort, staying out of the way. And a journalist approaches him and asks what he thinks of the press conference the sheriff has scheduled for that afternoon. Alan's reaction is, "Excuse me? What press conference?" Basically, nobody has told him that there's been a press conference scheduled. In fact, the sheriff did schedule a press conference for that afternoon at the trailhead, but did not inform any of the family. He didn't let any of them know that there was even going to be a press conference held. That afternoon, October 4th, Alan's family starts showing up. His twin brother Arlen, his sister-in-law, his mother, and his aunt arrive. They've all traveled from out of state. Alan's mom, his sister-in-law, and his aunt left the resort to go to the trailhead because they wanted to see if they could walk up the trail to see the area where Jared had disappeared. They just wanted to see the last spot where he had been seen. After they had left, there was a phone call for the sheriff's liaison that was there at the resort, and she was told she was needed because members of the family were making a scene. Alan hears this, and he and his brother head out to the trail. I also actually heard Alan discuss this, and he said he actually heard it come across the radio where somebody said, "The Atadeiros are causing problems. If they don't stop, we're going to have to arrest them." So Alan and Arlen head out to the trail to see what, you know, try to defuse the situation, see what's going on. On the way to the trail, they pass their mom, their aunt, and the sister-in-law heading back to the resort, which is odd because they're supposed to be at the trailhead causing this massive issue that is going to get people arrested. Finally, the women end up returning to the trailhead right before the press conference starts, and Alan asks them what the heck happened. And they said they asked to go up the trail. They were told no. So they decided to go back to the resort for warmer clothes and to get supplies for a few of the men in the Air Force. Which is really strange, because if they were causing such a commotion and were able to leave right away and they were going to be helpful and get things for the Air Force members, why would they have to be threatened with being arrested? And why in the world would a sheriff's department make that threat to the family of a missing three-year-old? It didn't seem like they were freaking out. I could understand it if they were like really, really getting in the faces of law enforcement or something, or doing something that would damage evidence or something like that. But in everything I've read, they really just wanted to walk far enough up the trail to see the last place he had been seen and then come back down. That's all they wanted. They were told no, so they were like, okay. I'm sure they probably were indignant about it, but I don't think that they were causing a scene to the point of needing to be threatened with arrest. After the press conference doesn't really offer any new information. And after the press conference, Alan begins to seriously consider if someone might have been able to take Jared. October 5th, 1999, Alan and his family head back to the trail where they talk to a captain who is relaying the leads that have come in that included a psychic giving vague information and someone who claimed they saw Jared in a Florida McDonald's. There's another person standing with the captain who says that a ranger at the Mesa Verde National Park swears he saw Jared there on Sunday, which is the day after he went missing. The captain assures the Atterdaros that all the leads are being checked into, even the ridiculous ones. Alan is shocked that with so many sightings, the sheriff is still adamant that Jared was on the mountain. The sheriff said, there's no way somebody took him off the mountain. Nobody abducted him. He's on this mountain. That was always his stance from day one. Finally, the family is allowed to go up the trail. And afterwards, after they come back down, the sergeant in charge tells Alan, you have caused us a lot of problems by wanting to come up this trail. And again, I don't know who these people in the sheriff's department think they are, and that it's appropriate to talk to a family of a victim this way, but they really didn't do anything to endear themselves to anyone. Alan is very gracious in his book in talking about members of law enforcement, but personally, the things that I have read about the interaction between some members of the law enforcement and members of the family, they were rude, they were threatening them, they did not communicate with them at all. The media was really the source of information for Alan most of the time. I just don't understand that. That just totally boggles my mind. I've never really heard of that kind of situation before. October 6th, Alan and his brother Arlen are traveling to appear on Good Morning America. And while they're in the car traveling, they hear about the two fishermen who were in the river fly fishing. And these are the ones that Jared had spoken to asking if there were bears. Apparently, the fishermen had urged Jared to return to his group. Alan had never been told about this detail of the investigation. And once again, he's learning from it from media. He was kind of frustrated that there were two people who could have saved Jared, could have prevented everything. If they had said, hey, you need to stay here with us and wait for your group to catch up with you. You know, you shouldn't go ahead by yourself. If they had just even just engaged and talked to him about fishing, talked to him about bears, anything, to keep him there until the adults caught up with him, he may not have ever gone missing. So they go for their Good Morning America interview. And during the interview, the sheriff insists, again, there's only one way up and one way down the trail. But at this point, Alan knows that Jocelyn and Janet came off the trail with no one noticing. At this point, he has also purchased several topographical maps of the area, and he has found numerous ways to get off of Big South Trail that do not require you to go back to the trailhead. So Alan knows, based on the maps that he has of the area, that there are ways to get off that trail. totally against what the sheriff is trying to say. After their interview, they leave. They head back to the trailhead. While they're there, Alan overhears a tracker mention a mountain lion. The tracker is talking to the sheriff, and the sheriff hears, you know, part of it, and the sheriff walks off. So Alan goes over and he asks the tracker to repeat the story. The tracker says, "I was on the east side of the trail, and I was following the prints of a small shoe, which could be Jared's. As I followed the trail, the shoe prints disappeared at the intersection of mountain lion prints. I wish the sheriff had stayed and listened to the rest of the story about what I found. I followed the tracks of the mountain lion for a long distance, and that cat never saw your son. There was no blood, clothes, dragging marks, or any sign of a struggle. I guarantee you that cat never saw your son." Because there were mountain lion tracks and everything, the Department of Wildlife was called in. And while they were waiting for Department of Wildlife to arrive, the sergeant in charge had Alan sit in what they called the war room so they could tell him what was going on with the search and bring him up to date, which was real nice of them since they couldn't be bothered to pick up the phone most of the time. So while they're discussing how the search dogs use scent to track, one of the search and rescue members passes the bag of Jared's clothes over Alan's head to the sergeant. When he did that, Alan says, "Wait a minute. Are those the clothes that you're using for the dogs to find Jared's scent?" And they're, "Yes, this is what we've been using with the dogs." The shorts in the bag were not Jared's. The shorts in the bag that they had been using as Jared's scent for the search dogs were Alan's shorts. No one stopped to question how a three-year-old could wear an adult's shorts. And Alan is not a small, petite, skinny guy. Definitely larger than a three-year-old. So Alan asks, how could anybody misinterpret a man's pair of shorts for something a small three-year-old boy would be wearing? And the search and rescue leader got up towards Alan, and he says, "We can call off the search right now." Which, again, who the heck says that to the father of a missing three-year-old? You have massively screwed up. You have an adult's pair of shorts that you're using as the scent item for your search and rescue dogs, and they're not even the clothing of the three-year-old who's missing. How are you going to find him? How are search and rescue dogs going to find this little boy without his scent? That's, like, ridiculous. I mean, it's not rocket science. So the sheriff has Alan send more of Jared's clothing, actual clothing, to the search to be used. But at this point, I mean, he goes missing on the 2nd. We're on the 6th. It's 4 days that he's been missing, and you've wasted 4 days worth of time because you've had Alan's shorts the whole time. So October 7th, Alan is reading a newspaper article, and he comes across the mention of 8 search and rescue personnel who were beginning to search 8 miles from the trailhead at Peterson Lake and work their way back to the area. It's mentioned that searchers feel the coverage of that particular area had been weak. Throughout the entire search, the sheriff kept insisting there was only one way in and one way out, and yet here was an area that had not been searched thoroughly that was another way off the trail. Someone could have taken Jared off the trail in that area, and it took 5 days to get someone there to search it. Alan has known this whole time there definitely were other ways off the trail. Yet the sheriff was insistent, nope, there's only one way in, one way out, and that's the trailhead parking lot. You have to, you know, go out the way you came in. But that was not the case. The Atadaros all felt there was no communication between law enforcement and the family about what was going on in the search. They didn't try. There was not even an attempt to have good communication. So October 8th, 1999, the search ends for Jared. There were more than 200 trained searchers, a dozen dog teams, professional trackers, a dive team, and a plane search for Jared. So after the search ends, the National Guard calls Alan and offers to send troops in to search for Jared, but they needed the sheriff to sign off on it. The sheriff refused, saying it would cost too much. He started out saying the cost would be $2,000 to $5,000 an hour to do the search. Then he says it's $5,000 an hour to do the search. Then he says it's $6,000 to do the search. Each time the sheriff is interviewed, the hourly amount changes and gets higher. So Alan is frustrated. He contacts the National Guard and he's told no, They would never charge $6,000 a day because that was their job and they're paid for by the taxpayers. Alan corrects them and he says, no, not by the day. The sheriff said it's $6,000 per hour. And the National Guard said they have never and that they would never charge that much to search for somebody and that they would have actually searched for Jared for free. 3 weeks after hearing about the Mesa Verde story, so just as a reminder, if you remember, Alan and his brother Arlen were talking to a captain who was discussing the different tips that had been coming in that included psychics and things like that. And there was a person, a search and rescue person or law enforcement or something, with the captain who mentioned that a park ranger had seen Jared in the Mesa Verde National Park. So 3 weeks after hearing about that, Alan speaks to the ranger who claims to have seen Jared. So it's 3 weeks after Alan hears about this. Alan discovers that he's the first person to have even contacted the ranger and that no one ever responded to the ranger's report. The ranger says that he noticed the young boy was very friendly and he thought it was odd that he wanted to hold his hand. So the young boy he met wanted to hold the ranger's hand. This actually was not something that was unusual for Jared. He was very friendly and he actually enjoyed holding people's hands. That was something that he did. The ranger said that the man that was with the boy was calling the boy something like Gerald. And the ranger didn't think anything of it until he saw on the news that Jared was missing and he saw his photo. The ranger saw the man and the boy the next day driving by him in a 1998 or 99 Silver Geo Tracker or Suzuki Sidekick, but he was unable to get the license plate number. He realized that they must have spent the night in the park. He was so sure it was Jared, he alerted the chief ranger and they searched the park for the vehicle, but they were unable to find it. So after speaking to the ranger, Alan asked the lead investigator from the sheriff's department about it. The investigator insisted it was followed up on, but upon looking further into it, it was realized that he had never actually contacted the ranger. So here you have somebody who is a ranger in a nearby national park. He is on a scale of 1 to 10. I believe he said he was a 7. As far as certainty that it was Jared. You've got the adult with him calling him something like Gerald, which is certainly extremely close to the name Jared. The boy looks like Jared. Like, he was certain that's who it was and even has some of the characteristics like Jared likes to hold hands. And the ranger said it was weird that the little boy wanted to hold his hand and nobody looked into it. It's 3 weeks after this came in and nobody's doing anything. The other thing of note is that the FBI refused to get involved with this case. David Pilates actually met with and talked to Alan Atadero. David Pilates points out that this is one of the strange things that happened because Jared disappeared in or near a national forest, and that's under the supervision and law enforcement control of the federal government, which would be the FBI. The Atadero family had made inquiries to get the assistance of the FBI, and they were told that there was no evidence of a crime and the FBI would not get involved. David Pilates says, I have written about dozens of cases which are very similar to Jared's disappearance where the FBI doesn't get directly involved, but they do have an agent or two who stays at the search and rescue center and monitors the case. Why they distinctly refuse to get involved is baffling and not consistent with past practices. Fast forward 2003, June 5th, two hikers are hiking on the Big South Trail. They take a detour up a rock scramble. I believe you would call it a boulder field. It's about 2,000 feet of elevation change, and technically, if you were to draw a line out to the trail and then straight down, it's 550 vertical feet above the trail. The hikers made a comment that you're scrambling to get up the rocks. You have to watch your feet, you have to focus, and you're only focusing about a few feet in front of you so you don't get injured. They were familiar with the story of Jared and his disappearance. It actually made national news. In fact, I think it was kind of a global story as well. There were people in other countries who knew about it. But it was big news, especially if you were from that area. So these hikers are familiar with Jared's story, and they had discussed what might have happened. That's about the time when they found the clothes and saw the shoe. The shoe that they found was relatively pristine, and it looked like somebody had just stepped out of it, like a few moments before. Altogether, they found two shoes, a brown fleece jacket, and blue sweatpants that were turned inside out. And one pant leg was missing from the knee down, but that was due to birds and small animals using the material for nesting. It wasn't because the leg was ripped off or anything, like the leg itself. It was just animals had, over the years, had been using the fleece to make their nest. So photos of the clothing get sent to Alan by the sheriff's department, and Alan identifies them as Jared's clothing. So June 6, 2003, searchers retrieve the clothes. On June 14, 2003, searchers, including Alan, begin looking for Jared's remains. Alan, in order to climb up this trail, boulder field, had to wear a helmet, and he had to climb on his hands and knees to reach the area where the clothing was located. And yet, everybody's thinking a three-year-old was capable of doing this. So an adult man is having trouble climbing up there, but somehow a three-year-old's going to manage to do that, or choose to do that. Like, I don't know a three-year-old who's going to make that choice. 11:30 a.m. on the 14th, searchers find a skull fragment in a crevice and a tooth on a log, 180 feet north and 20 feet higher than where the clothing is found. Searchers said they know the area was searched, but they never found anything. So searchers are certain that this area had been searched already. They had already looked here, and yet they never saw any of this. The clothing was sent to CBI, which is the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and they sent that for testing. And it came back that there was no blood, no tissue, no mountain lion hairs were found on the clothing. The jacket was 100% intact, and there were no traces of mountain lion DNA on any of the items. Because I can tell you right now, mountain lion attack is what the sheriff said. You know, that's what the assumption is. He gets attacked by a mountain lion. Alan just isn't buying the whole mountain lion thing, because if a mountain lion attacks you, you would think that there would be some type of blood evidence, something that the mountain lion attacked. So he contacted some mountain lion experts, and they said that what's going to happen is the mountain lion is going to go for the stomach or like the neck area first, because those are soft, fleshy areas. And yet there is nothing indicating on the clothing that any of this happened. There's no rips or tears at the neckline of the clothing. There's no rips or tears in the stomach area where of the clothing. There's no blood. There's nothing. And the experts said that it's not a mountain lion attack. So authorities explained that there was no blood because whatever attacked Jared took his clothes off first. I don't know about you, but the last time I was checking on mountain lions, they did not have opposable thumbs and were not capable of taking the clothes off of their prey. Also, I don't really think a mountain lion is going to take the time to strip their victim naked before they eat them. I don't think they really care. I mean, I've never heard of any animal other than a human undressing their prey, ever. Like, it makes no sense. So the tooth was also sent out for DNA analysis, and the DNA on the tooth actually ended up coming back with more than one person's DNA. It was said to be contaminated, and a DNA expert said there's no way two people's DNA should be found on the tooth at all. In regards to the DNA on the tooth, Alan sent the DNA analysis off to a private lab, to an expert, and this is the information he got back regarding the DNA for the tooth. Hi, Alan. You have my sympathies regarding the search for your son. There are two things about the information you provided to me that strike me as being not quite right. First, a sample from a tooth should not be a mixture, which means that it contains the DNA of two or more individuals, if the test and extractions were performed correctly. At the very least, a mixture for such a sample would mean that some contamination occurred, and DNA testing labs are usually very careful to avoid any possibility of contamination or mishandling of samples. Second, the genetic markers that are used for the purpose of human identification are called loci, in the plural, but an individual marker is referred to as a locus, singular. While attorneys and laypeople are not sensitive to the difference between the singular and plural form of that word, professionals who work in DNA testing labs are almost always hypersensitive to it and rarely use them incorrectly. this DNA expert says that it's either contaminated or mishandled, which typically isn't what happens when you go to a lab. So it's very strange that it's very strange about the DNA that found on the tooth. Unfortunately, the tooth was destroyed in the attempt to get the DNA from it, so there's no more sample to test. There were hairs that were found on the jacket, but they were unidentifiable. They could not determine who or what the hair was from, which struck me as a little odd. The shoes are considered pristine. Alan had identical shoes that he had purchased so that the searchers had the exact tread. So wherever Alan had purchased the shoes, he went back and purchased the same exact shoes, and that way they knew exactly what the tread of the shoe would look like if they found shoe prints. So Alan uses these extra shoes in an experiment to see how the shoes weather, and he left shoes out in the elements to see what would happen. He actually posted this on the Facebook page that he used to have. It's not there anymore, but I did see this where he had one set of shoes that he kept to the control shoe so you could see what they looked like new, and then he had the other shoe that was sitting outside, and it didn't take long at all for them to start fading and deteriorating. And yet the shoes that were found at the top of this boulder field were pretty close to brand new looking. Alan also mentions that the shoes were not scuffed at all. So if he had been dragged up the boulder field, the shoes should have some sort of marks on them from being dragged across the rocks. And also, Jared did not like to tie his shoes, so Alan would allow him to wear them without tying them, and they would have been loose and flopping. And in that instance, being dragged up a boulder field, they should have come off his feet long before they ever made it to the top of that elevation change. Alan also talked to a man who had actually been attacked by a mountain lion and survived. And the guy said that when he was attacked by the mountain lion, there was blood everywhere. All over his clothing, his shoes, everywhere. There, all over the area where he was attacked. So for there to be absolutely no blood on any article of clothing, it just didn't make any sense whatsoever. It really was ruling out a mountain lion attack. So then it was reported that the absence of any stains that might have come from blood or other decomposition fluids indicated the clothes were removed from the victim prior to the time any significant bleeding or decomp occurred. So that's the official word, that Jared was not wearing his clothes when he would have been attacked, where a significant amount of blood would have been around or before decomposition occurred or anything. So if you got to think about this for a minute. If Jared gets to the top with his clothing on, and that's the clothing has to get to the top of the boulder field. So Jared didn't take off his clothes and climb up the boulder field. That didn't happen. If Jared had taken his clothes off down on the bottom of the trail, his clothes would have been found right near the trail. So he had to get to the top of this boulder field, this really, really steep slope, with his clothes on in order for the clothes to have been found where they were. The other thing of note was the fact that the pants were found inside out. That is more like when you pull off your pants, and sometimes like these were sweatpants, when you're sloppy about it, you pull them off and they end up coming off inside out because they get stuck on your ankle or your foot or whatever, and you pull it off and you pull the pant leg inside out. It was also interesting to note that Alan mentioned that there was a comment made on Fox News that they should find at least a tooth. And then a few days later, shockingly, they find a tooth. And the tooth was laying right out in the open. They never found any other bones. They only found the skull cap and the tooth. That was it. When Jared's tooth was found, it was located sitting on top of a bed of needles in plain view. You would think that after 4 winters being left out there, it would be covered up by some pine needles or buried by debris or leaves or something. But it was sitting right there out in the open. There's actually photos of the tooth where they found it. I will try to post in the social media. There was a press conference called after they found everything, and the sheriff stated he wasn't positive what happened to Jared. He thought it was possible that a mountain lion had killed him, but there wasn't significant evidence to even support that. As I mentioned, there were hairs that were collected off of the collar of Jared's coat, of his fleece jacket, and they were sent to the lab. Alan was eventually told that the hairs were non-human and not mountain lion, but not to worry about it. They never gave Alan the hair report, and they never told him what the hairs belonged to. So David Pilates says this, "Think this through clearly. You are the investigator, and you are attempting to understand what killed a small boy. Wouldn't you want to know what those hairs belong to? Hair and fiber experts know what every animal hair looks like. They have a guide to every hair in the wilderness, and it's their job to match them. Why wasn't this completed? Why wasn't Alan given a copy of the hair report? He was given the DNA report and every other imaginable report except this one. He still doesn't have it. I don't think he has it even to this day." Jared's personal items that were not found were the lower jaw, the rest of his teeth, his t-shirt, his underwear. None of those items were recovered. It's not unusual to not find the mandible because the mandible is not attached to the skull. There is no bone that attaches your lower jaw to your skull. It's all ligaments. So once they would decay and decompose, there's nothing holding your mandible to the rest of your skull, and it's easily lost or taken by predators. Alan also, at one point, received a phone call from a man who said the sheriff's department was not telling him everything and that eventually the truth would come out, but he wouldn't say who he was or where he was from. Alan actually received quite a few crazy calls. A woman who said that Jared was in a concentration camp. There actually was another gentleman who called and actually claimed to be Jared. He's not Jared. It was proven he wasn't Jared. I think Alan actually had a restraining order taken out against this guy because he was harassing him at work. He was harassing his, you know, other people at his work. And they knew there was no way that he could be Jared because Jared's skull cap was found and extensive DNA testing was done on it later, and it came back conclusive that it definitely was Jared's skull cap. But still, this guy still tried to say that he was Jared. So there were a lot of people who came out, the crazies come out to say a lot of crazy things, make a lot of crazy claims. This is basically the story of Jared Atadero's disappearance. He disappeared hiking with 11 adults and his six-year-old sister on the Big South Trail. His remains, or what was left of him, and his clothing, articles of his clothing, were found 4 years after his disappearance. And they were found, as I said, 550 vertical feet above the trail. It's a 2,000 foot elevation change in a very short distance. That means it's a very difficult hike. As I mentioned, Alan Atadero, Jared's father, had to wear a helmet and use his hands and knees to actually make the climb when he went with law enforcement. They made him wear a helmet for safety. That's a pretty significant climb. If you're a hiker, you should be familiar with that kind of elevation change. There's a trail near here where I live where it's like 1400 foot elevation change in like a quarter of a mile or a half a mile. And there were areas where I'm climbing hands and knees type of climb. It was incredibly difficult. And I can't imagine a three-year-old being able to do that, especially a three-year-old who didn't like to tie his shoes. I think that Alan is correct in thinking that it is very possible somebody was able to take Jared off the trail without anybody noticing. It seems like a lot of the members of the group really weren't paying attention to what was going on with the kids. Jocelyn stayed right with Janet, but Jared, he was having a good time. It's even said that he was like hiding in the bushes along the trail and jumping out and trying to scare the adults as they came by. So I don't think it would be very difficult for somebody to grab a child or encourage a child to go off with them. I really think that the ranger at the Mesa Verde National Park was right. I think he actually did see Jared that day. I think they took Jared and they left the park, left the Big South Trailhead, went to this other park, and that Jared never actually spent a night in the Big South Trail area. I don't think he ever actually stayed there overnight. I think they took him out the day that he went missing. There were reports of the reason why the sheriff did not use infrared technology was because there were wild men, squatters, people who living off-grid, didn't like the government, and they were in the woods, and they didn't want to use infrared because they didn't want to have confrontations with these people. So if you know you have these people living in the woods, why wouldn't you confront these people and ask them if they saw anything or look for Jared in those areas? It's similar to Dennis Martin in that they knew that there were wild men, as they called it, living in the woods. And by wild men, I don't mean crazy wild race of humans or something. I mean basically people who are hermits or who want to live off grid, and they're living off the land in the woods, in the deep woods. That's what I'm referring to as wild men. So why wouldn't you want to confront these people? There was a similar one, as I said, with Dennis Martin, where somebody actually saw one of these wild men with something over their shoulder, and it was red. And when Dennis Martin went missing, he was wearing a red polo shirt. So here we have another instance of a young child going missing. Jared was 3, Dennis Martin was 7, but there are known squatters, wild men, what have you, living in the area in the woods. And the sheriff's department's like, well, we don't want to use infrared because we don't want to have to confront any of these people. Hello, they're living in the woods where a 3-year-old boy has gone missing. Why would you not confront them? Now, this report didn't come directly from the sheriff's department. This came from somebody else. Is it 100% factual? I'm not really sure, but I kind of tend to believe that that is the case, because there were people, as I mentioned, who had infrared capabilities on their planes, and they were not asked to aid in the search. Why wouldn't you use infrared to help find a 3-year-old boy? There's a lot of problems with this case. There's still a lot of questions. I don't think this was a mountain lion attack. I don't think this was a bear attack. I don't think a wild animal attacked Jared at all. You would have seen an indication on his clothing. An animal is not going to undress its prey before it eats it. First of all, none of the animals that I've mentioned, bear, mountain lion, wolf, coyote, none of these animals have opposable thumbs. How are they going to get the clothing off? The jacket was not inside out. The pants were inside out. But I don't know of any animal that undresses its prey, except for humans. My conclusion with this case is that somebody came across Jared. I don't think they went in search of him. I think it was kind of crime of opportunity, which happens often. Bad person, right place at the right time for them. Wrong place at the wrong time for Jared. And I think he was taken. And I think he was taken off of the trail right away. I think he was the boy that was seen by the ranger in the Mesa Verde Park. And I think that whoever took him brought his remains back to the Big South Trail and put them in an area that was searched already. That's kind of my thought process. My heart really, really goes out to Alan Atadero. He was such an advocate for his child, even after he knew his child was gone, that he wasn't coming back. And yet he still fought for the truth to get the answers. At one time, Alan was asked what he believed happened. He just said, I don't believe anything. I don't want to believe one thing over another thing. And it's just so sad. So that does it for this episode. As always, you can find our episodes wherever it is that you listen to your favorite podcasts. We're on all the major ones and most of the not major ones. You can also find us at lurkpodcast.com, and there we also have links to our social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and we have a YouTube channel. So check that out. And I always encourage you to like or follow or, you know, subscribe, whatever it is that you do, to one or all of them. Personally, I think all of them, because sometimes I put things on one and not the other. Anyway, that's where I post any photos that are important to the episode that has been released. So I will be putting photos of Jared and photos of the clothing that was found and the tooth and things like that will be posted on social media. So definitely go like that so you can check out anything that I post on there. Also, any important links or event information, anything like that, is posted on the social media as well. A reminder that we will be at the Sasquatch Calling Festival in Whitehall, New York on Saturday, September 25th. So come out and say hey. We also have a couple of new shirts in the merch store, and you can find that at lurkpodcastmerch.com. Go there, check it out. We've got some new sweatshirts, some t-shirts, and they're pretty awesome. So with that, I think that'll do it for this episode completely. And as always, keep lurking.